Hello and welcome to MPN Forum Live, the only podcast designed exclusively for patients and caregivers of MPNs, which include the following blood cancers: PV, ET, and myelofibrosis. It's also the home to MPN patient storytelling. From the dawn of time, human beings have shared a deep history of bonding with each other through storytelling. These stories provide MPN patients and their families with a unique experience not easily replicated on traditional social platforms. Besides patient stories, from time to time, we will feature guest hosts, caregivers, hematologists, and experts who can provide insight into medical breakthroughs, as well as the benefits of exercise, a well-balanced diet, and meditation. MPN Forum is funded through donations from our listeners, and we have been fortunate to have received grants from CTI Biopharma and Insight. MPN Forum Live is completely independent from any outside influence and are reliant on donations from our listeners. Anyone interested in making a much-appreciated donation can go to our website, mpnforumlive.com, and please click on the donation tab, and you can donate via check or PayPal. All views and comments presented on MPN Forum Live are the opinions of our guests and hosts and are not to be taken as professional medical advice. Always check with your hematologist or oncologist should you be interested in learning more about a topic discussed on MPN Forum Live. Today's guest on MPN Forum Live is Hugh Rienhoff, a San Francisco-based clinical physician, scientist, and entrepreneur. He is the chief executive officer and founder of Imago Biosciences, a clinical stage biopharmaceutical company discovering and developing novel small molecule product candidates that target LSD1, an enzyme that plays a central role in the production of blood cells in the bone marrow. Imago is focused on improving the quality and length of life for patients with cancer and bone marrow diseases like MPNs. Biomedemstat is an orally available small molecule inhibitor of LSD1, is the lead product candidate discovered by Imago for the treatment of certain MPMs, a family of related chronic cancers of the bone marrow. Imago is evaluating this drug as a potentially disease-modifying therapy in phase 2 clinical trials for the treatment of ET and myelofibrosis. The drug currently has U.S. FDA orphan drug and fast-track designation for the treatment of ET and MF, European Medicines Agency, or EMA, orphan designation for the treatment of ET and MF, and priority medicines designations by the EMA for the treatment of MF. The company is based in South San Francisco, California. Hello, Hugh, and welcome to MPN Forum Live.
Thank you, Jeremy. Really a pleasure to be a guest.
Well, it's always exciting to talk about new drugs. It's probably the number one topic most of our members are looking for because, everyone as a patient is hopeful that there'll be something besides the stem cell transplant, which is a grueling process and not always successful. And we've seen a lot of progress over the last few years. And if you don't mind, let's start off talking about how your company was started and how you came across this drug.
Yeah, absolutely. So the company was founded 10 years ago. Here in San Francisco, and it was founded not just by me, but by four other founders, all women, who were part of a previous company that we together ran called Ferricen, which was acquired by Shire, and that was focused on hematology as well. And we wanted to stay together, And we were very fortunate to have investors who were willing to invest in us in another company. The target LSD1 or lysine specific demethylase, which is not to be confused with the hallucinogenic compound. LSD1 is an enzyme, as you say, in the bone marrow. It's actually elsewhere in the body, but it's doing its main job in adults, regulating blood cell development. And it plays a critical role in both stem cells and the biology of stem cells, as well as the maturation of cells that make the cells we're familiar with, like platelets and white cells and red cells. I was directed by the former lab leader I worked with when I was at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, to a meeting down in near Monterey here in California. That was a hematology meeting, and I heard about lysine-specific demethylase, or LSD1, and I began to understand how it might be useful in a number of different myeloid diseases, that is to say, bone marrow diseases that affect red cells or white cells or platelets. And to make a very long story short, Amy and her crew, who head up chemistry, developed bomedemstat, which is our LSD1 inhibitor. And we first put it into patients with acute myeloid leukemia. And we did that study in Australia in 2016 and 2017. And we got a good sense in those patients what the safety profile is, how to dose it, the pharmacokinetics, et cetera. And during that study, we happened to talk to an investigator at Memorial Sloan Kettering who was focused on the myeloproliferative neoplasms and had several different mouse models. And we agreed that it would be useful to test bomedemstat in those mouse models. And we got terrific results showing spleen volume reduction, decrease in inflammatory cytokines, and all the other things that you would want to see. And this was the same laboratory that had tested ruxolitinib when it was not yet in humans. So it was a good reference lab for us. So we took bomedemstat into clinical trials for the treatment of patients who had failed ruxolitinib in myelofibrosis, for the treatment of myelofibrosis. And that study, we enrolled 89 patients, and those patients have been on the study for now more than a year, some actually almost 3 years now. In the middle of that study, we started a study in essential thrombocythemia. And those were patients who had failed at least one standard of care. And standard of care is typically hydroxyurea. Some patients get interferon and some patients get anagrelide. But the vast majority of patients in this study were those who had failed hydroxyurea in one way or another. And that study is fully enrolled now. We had 73 patients in that study. And they will come up on their 24-week this December, and those patients will be followed indefinitely as long as they're achieving some kind of clinical benefit. And we plan to start a phase 3 study early next year for the treatment of essential thrombocythemia. Bomedemstat, we believe is relatively safe and tolerable drug, and can be effective actually for all three of the MPNs as far as we know. And this is obviously based initially on mouse models of PV and ET and MF. And we're testing each of those diseases with bomedemstat currently.
Great. And so how do you see this progressing? Like, what are the next steps to get some of the larger researchers on board, like the MD Andersons of the world, to develop a full-scale clinical study in the U.S.?
Well, it's a great question. So we, our phase three study, or I should say our phase two study in myelofibrosis and in essential thrombocythemia, are global studies that include 26 sites across the world, Hong Kong, Italy, Australia, the UK, Germany, the US, et cetera. So we're already reaching out to all of the key investigators around the world who are serious trialists. And we will do the same thing we did the same thing with ET, and many of those investigators are the same that were studying bomedemstat for the treatment of MF. And for PV, we're reaching out to those same investigators and different ones as well. And again, that will be a global study. And we've already got some preliminary data suggesting that our effort in PV is going to be well rewarded. And the phase three study will be a much bigger study, as you might suggest. It will have over 100 sites, and it will include virtually all of the important trialists across the globe in probably 20 different countries.
Right. And for our worldwide audience, for those that are in the United States, how do they get more information on this drug, and how do they, when can, in your mind, do you think they can expect to be able to start signing up for clinicals in the United States?
Well, for essential thrombocythemia, that phase three study is expected to start early next year. And our website, Imago Bio, I-M-A-G-O-B-I-O, which is short for Imago Biosciences. So imagobio.com, all lowercase, one word, has a lot of information about bomedemstat, some of the publications that we've had, and certainly all of the presentations that we've given to in the public forums. We've presented at ASH several times. We presented our data at the European Hematology Association. Those are the two big meetings that we attend each year. And that's about the right pace for us because, these are long studies. And a data cut every 6 months is essentially how that works for us. So we will be represented at ASH again this December, and all of that data will be actually available to the public in a couple of weeks. The data that we presented to ASH for consideration of presentations, and so our website is a fairly rich resource for both the diseases, but also bomedemstat itself.
Right. And then I know these things are harder. It's a harder question to answer because I'm coming at it from a patient's perspective versus, a pharmaceutical company, which has certain regulations and certain things they can say and can't say, But from a patient's perspective, what are some of the things that the drug so far has proven that it can do besides reducing spleen size? Is there any data that's shown that it slows the progression of any of the diseases?
It's a great question. And, bomedemstat, I would say, is on the cutting edge of science. It targets a completely different enzyme than, say, any of the JAK inhibitors, which are, there are four of those. Bomedemstat is playing a role. It's inhibiting the enzyme that's critical for how stem cells divide, and particularly those that contain mutations. And so we're quite keen to understand and understand the clinical relevance of the observation that we've made in our studies that patients with myelofibrosis and ET, and even in PV, we believe, that we see a reduction in the frequency of mutations. And specifically, we measure the frequency of those mutations at the time they come into the study. So a patient might have 50% of their cells might contain a JAK2 mutation, for example. And over the course of time, usually that frequency increases as the disease progresses. So it's encouraging for us to see the frequency of those mutations go down. However, because we're waiting to make a clinical correlation between that. For example, if you see the frequency of the mutations go down, does that mean that your overall survival is extended? Or does that mean you have a lower chance of developing AML? Or do you have a lower chance of experiencing bone marrow failure? And those questions are, I would say, at this point, unanswered. But the suggestion is that if the frequency of the mutation is going down, it's probably a good thing. But it's incumbent upon us to make that clinical correlation. And that's why these patients who have completed a year of treatment are in what we call an extension study, so that we can follow the long-term clinical course of these patients and begin to make that connection between clinical outcomes and, you know, overall survival, progression to AML, to bone marrow failure, to these changes in mutant allele frequencies.
Interesting. So, you know, one of the things that I was always surprised by was my doctor, who unfortunately isn't with us anymore, at Stanford, Stanley Schreier, was not a believer in JAK2 drugs. That he felt that they were just short-term Band-Aids and that a solution will come eventually from a pharmaceutical company that is focused outside of just impacting the JAK2 inhibitors. Any thoughts on that at all?
Well, I'm sort of in that same camp, in the sense that not to say that JAK inhibitors don't provide patients with relief from symptoms and splenomegaly, for sure. There's no question about that. But as you probably know, splenomegaly has never been associated, whether you have a big spleen or a little spleen, with your outcome. You know, and if you shrink the spleen, does that mean you live longer? No, there's no evidence of that. If you shrink the spleen, do you have less chance of getting AML? There's no evidence at all for that. So in that sense, Dr. Schreier has a lot to back his skepticism up. There's no question in my mind that there needs to be a different way of thinking about the treatment of these diseases, because we can treat somewhat, effectively the symptoms and signs of the disease. But the question is, are we really impacting that fundamental stem cell that contains the mutation and continues to dominate the bone marrow until it's acquired new mutations or it's a dominant clone? So there's no question that the real aspiration of all of us who want to have an impact on the outcomes in these patients, we have to be focused on that stem cell. And one of the reasons we got interested in LSD1 10 years ago is because of some studies in AML showing that inhibiting LSD1, and this was in mouse models to be clear, that inhibiting LSD1 actually reduced the population of stem cells that contain those mutations. So that's why the clinical correlation between outcomes, meaningful clinical outcomes, and this reduction in mutant allele frequency is so important to make. And that's one of our ambitions, is to make that connection in these longer term studies.
So I think we had, when we were discussing on our pre-call, you said something about potentially combining your drug with another drug. And I wanted to, give you some time to elaborate on that, because that's becoming quite a bit more common, especially in Europe. It's taking the United States a lot longer to gain approval on those type of things. But the European community's medical community seems to be moving much at a faster rate.
Right. So the combination study that we're about to initiate, and this, you know, this will be relatively soon, outside. In fact, it is outside the United States, our first site. And that is the combination of ruxolitinib plus bomedemstat, our drug. And the thesis there is that LSD1 is obviously working at a completely different level than a JAK2 inhibitor. As I said, it's regulating stem cell biology as well as the maturation of megakaryocytes and other, you know, terminally differentiated blood cells. You know, our view was if a patient is on ruxolitinib, but they haven't experienced as much benefit as physician would like or the patient would like, if their symptom scores were still unacceptable or they couldn't increase the dose of ruxolitinib because of anemia or other causes, untoward effects, that maybe adding bomedemstat on top of the rux regimen would you know, be beneficial, partly because bomedemstat works in a completely different way. So it wouldn't be antagonizing anything that ruxolitinib would be doing. And so we're going to start that study. We've done those kinds of studies in mice, and they have encouraged us to do that same kind of study in humans. We obviously are using ruxolitinib because that is the JAK inhibitor that physicians are most comfortable using, so there's not going to be a lot of dosing issues compared to perhaps using another JAK inhibitor where the dosing might be, you know, there's less experience doing that. So we're excited about that combination study. You know, my gut feeling is that when you add something to ruxolitinib, you have to be mindful of the fact that every drug you add potentially brings side effects. So what we don't want to do, and we don't expect to see this, but I think you can see this in some of the combinations that have already been published, that you don't want to bring in GI toxicity or other issues and make patients' lives more miserable just to get the spleen down, you know, another 20%. I think, you know, that's an unacceptable trade-off. I think what we'd be looking for is to get the symptoms and the signs under control, but then add another dimension of effectiveness that currently JAK inhibition doesn't offer.
So why does it take so long to get these new drugs approved, in your opinion? You know, when I think MPN patients saw how fast the COVID vaccines were rushed through, and then, you know, wonder why can't they do the same thing for myelofibrosis patients or PV patients?
Well, I think there are a couple of things, and it's a fair question, I think. What I would argue, there are a couple reasons. One is that particularly recently, there have been a huge number of trials in myelofibrosis. So there's intense competition for patients. And there are multiple studies going on at any one institution. And so even within an institution, you find studies competing for patients, you know, which makes it very difficult to enroll. You know, a patient could be in one study for 24 weeks and then switched over to another study for 24 weeks and whatever. So there's a competition for patients. That's one thing. And I think that will slow down as a lot of these drugs sort of progress through development. And, you know, the decision is made whether to apply for approval or not, marketing approval. I think the other thing is that these are chronic diseases, it takes a long time to demonstrate effectiveness. Another element of this is there's a lot of heterogeneity in these patient populations. Myelofibrosis is not just one condition. You know, that if you think about chronic myeloid leukemia, you have one mutation that really dominates everything, and there's nothing else, at least in the early stages of the disease. So you can get one particular drug to inhibit that particular mutation, and it's very clear, you know, then the blast cells go down or the malignant cells go down. But in myelofibrosis, the clinical measures like spleen, we were talking about the spleen, which is, you know, splenomegaly is a concern for some patients, but not all patients. And, you know, if a, you know, looking at that, it takes time for that spleen to shrink, and the clinical relevance of that has come into, you know, some question, I would say. And I think the FDA is right to spend more time on how patients feel and what their symptom scores are and their general well-being. Whereas earlier, I think there was a, sort of a, an intense focus on splenomegaly, which, you know, if you look at the old literature, a lot of patients had splenomegaly and didn't even know it, you know, if the spleen wasn't massively enlarged, because it grows slowly. So I think those are a couple, although I would say that the FDA is quite interested in facilitating the development of these drugs. There's no indication to me that the FDA is kind of holding back. I think they want good, clean data. And, you know, that's hard to come by because of the heterogeneity of the disease. And also because, like you pointed out, these JAK inhibitors, you know, have variable impact on the natural history of the disease. Most patients kind of march forward despite symptom improvement and spleen volume reduction. So I think the FDA and the clinical community are in some ways between a rock and a hard place if they really admit that, which is, you know, what is the most important outcome we want to measure here? Is it overall survival? That takes a long time. You know, is it transformation to AML? Is it, you know, is it spleen volume reduction? You know, those are that's the simplest thing to do. So I think it's a challenging area to be developing. In essential thrombocythemia, I think the story is very different. There hasn't been a drug approved for that treatment for more than 20 years. There's only one drug approved, and it's not very favored by clinicians. That's anagrelide. So most patients get hydroxyurea, which is a fairly blunt instrument for treating any disease. So I think the development of bomedemstat for the treatment of ET actually will go fairly smoothly compared to what you see in myelofibrosis. That's my personal view, yeah.
Yeah, in my view about Hydrea, and as I mentioned on a pre-call, I was on Hydrea for 22 years, is that it has a tendency to give the patient a sense of comfort, because a false sense of comfort and safety or security, because it alleviates, you know, it drops the platelets usually very well. It's an inexpensive drug that is easy to get approved. And, you know, it manages things well. On the other side of the coin with Hydrea is that it does nothing to prevent the disease from progressing or the fibrosis from getting worse. And so, like in my case, you can get a false sense of security that you're, hey, I'm managing this thing. Everything's going great. And then you wake up one morning like I did and you had myelofibrosis. And so still doesn't mean that I wouldn't have transitioned to myelofibrosis no matter what was done. And that's always the tricky part. But, you know, when you look at some of the drugs that are out there today, they're a vast improvement, I think, over the standard of Hydrea. But there still are risks, and a lot of our members that have ET do complain that they feel like there's a ton of work, as you pointed out, going on discovery for myelofibrosis and PV, but not they don't hear as often about new drugs for ET, and I think that's a good point that you brought up, and I'm always getting asked, have you heard anything? Is there anything going on out there? So I appreciate what you've been sharing.
Well, I think I think ED patients kind of get the short end of the stick, to be honest with you, because there's this perception among many clinicians, I think, that it's a benign disease, and it doesn't really affect patient quality of life. But I think that when you dig in deeply and look at the voice of the patient types of transcripts, you find actually that, yes, the symptom scores are not as high as those with myelofibrosis. However, fatigue is a major component of their life with the disease. And even though that's only 10% of the total symptom score, they may score a 9 on that. And that is really impairing life. So I think one of the things that, you know, we would like to achieve, you know, as we bring bomedemstat forward for the treatment of ET, is to try to make physicians more aware of the fact of what the symptom ET. I think that's underappreciated.
Yeah, well, there's also a vast difference in the quality of care and knowledge between a doctor who is part of MD Anderson or Mayo or Stanford or Hutch versus Bob the hematologist. And I'm not knocking Bob, because there's very competent hematologists out there that have their own practices, but a lot of them don't have the time to do the type of research that's being done at a Stanford or Hutch. And so the patient doesn't get access to some of the knowledge in the same way they do going to a center. And I know Dr. Mesa has been very outspoken about the need to spend more time educating patients that either can't afford to go to a hematologist at a major research center, don't have health insurance, things like that, that impact the daily lives of those patients that go to, like, if you have a conversation over a cup of coffee at a Starbucks with a patient that's going to a major research facility versus someone that's going to their local hematologist, that discussion is so different because they just have access to so much data, including many times libraries and research centers that they'll allow their patients to have access to. And so there's kind of like a have and a have not, that unless that doctor goes out of his way to attend to ASH and do other things, you're right. There is a challenge with getting the knowledge base with ET patients and other patients as well to make it a little bit more equal.
Yeah, I that's a general problem, to be honest with you, in medicine.
Sure.
There's a lot of inequality, not just financial inequality, but let's say geographic inequality, access, if you're in the middle of nowhere, and the burden that it takes to go to a center of high competence. And then there's this information gap, which extends all the way to the physician. You know, my daughter has a genetic condition, and so I'm involved with a lot of other parents who have children with genetic conditions. And what strikes me about, let's say the parents or even the patients, who are pretty motivated, their knowledge gets pretty close to the knowledge of the expert. And there's a little bit of a gap, but the gap is not much. I will tell you that the gap between what we don't know and what we'd like to know is much, much greater than the gap between a motivated patient and a well-informed doctor. And so, what I've found historically, and this was my experience when I was treating AIDS patients in the 90s, is that we really had nothing. And so the patient and the physician really became partners. And we taught patients how to recognize infections early on so that they could jump on them right away, as opposed to waiting another 24 hours or 48 hours to see how it evolved. You know, these patients needed to be treated instantly. And that kind of doctor-patient relationship really, I think, is the most productive. Where there's a partnership, there's not some giant gap between, you know, the patient and the physician. So it's, I think it's incumbent upon Imago to facilitate that kind of education and both make information accessible to the patient as well as to the physicians to narrow that gap as much as possible.
So we're coming up on the hour, and I just wanted to make sure we have just enough time for one or two other points. If there's anything else you would like all of our members to know about your company and what you're doing, or any other subject.
Well, I think you know, these next 5 years are going to be interesting because I think what we'll see is the dust will settle with respect to combinations for myelofibrosis. My own personal belief is that ruxolitinib will be the go-to for quite a while because so many physicians are familiar with it and they know what to expect, except under, unusual circumstances where a patient might be severely anemic or severely thrombocytopenic. I see combinations taking hold, but only if the tolerability profile of the combination is acceptable. I think that's a really important thing for patients. Patients are not going to accept an additional agent if they don't feel better. It's got to make them feel better, and you can't substitute one symptom for another symptom. You know, that's right. Not a good deal. You know, diarrhea for fever or something. Just to be silly. So I think we're going to see the dust settle. I think there are 11 combination studies going on, and maybe ours will be the 12th. But I'm hopeful because of the distinct biological properties that bomedemstat has, which we, you know, it's incumbent upon us to prove that they are clinically relevant. But that's certainly our ambition. And I would say the long run is that we will develop therapies, and maybe bomedemstat is one, it's too early to tell, that actually get to the issue that Stanley Schreier was talking about, which is, are we going to affect that the reservoir of disease, which is the stem cell in the bone marrow? That's the real reservoir of disease. And can we go after that cell and eliminate it and therefore stop bone marrow failure, stop progression to AML? I think that's the dream that we have.
Great. Well, I appreciate you coming on and sharing what you're doing, and appreciate the fact that there's going to be more options in the future for all MPN patients. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, Jeremy. Nice to chat with you.